特许金融街
China Charter Chat。
Hi everyone, welcome to China Charter Chat, the English broadcast released by CFA Society Beijing. Today we have a special guest, Simon, the president of CFA Society Singapore. Hi Simon, can you say hi to our audience and briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi Stella. Hi Beijing Society. Very good morning to all of you. And it is my pleasure to be invited to this chat session with the Beijing Society. So allow me to introduce myself a little bit. My name is what Stella has introduced, Simon Ng, currently president of CFA Society Singapore. In my day job, I am the CEO of RHB Asset Management in Singapore, responsible for about 2.5 billion Sing dollar worth of AUM, investing into a multi-asset platform across public equities, fixed income, as well as alternative investment. Beside all these involvements that I have, I'm also currently involved quite actively in the various form of organization that spread across charities as well as tertiary institution. For example, I'm also currently the director of the Singapore Arts Theatre that focus on very much on Chinese cultural performing arts. I'm also a very active volunteer in the Singapore University of Social Sciences. I'm currently also the chair of the Program Academic Council within the Faculty of Business Administration in SUSS. And also, I'm one of the fellow within the Singapore University of Social Sciences as well. So yeah, that's a very sort of a brief introduction of myself, and over to you, Stella.
Okay, thank you, Simon. As you mentioned, you've been working full-time and part-timely for asset management companies and universities. So we want to first ask your opinion about the global financial markets and your asset allocation for the coming year, 2024.
Right. Yes, thank you very much for the question. Well, I think we can all envision that 2023 has been quite a difficult market for every one of us globally. I think while investors have adapted to pandemic disruptions, rising geopolitical risk, soaring inflation, I think it has been quite a turbulence that investors have navigated through in 2023, particularly coming through almost to 2.5 years of lockdown due to pandemic that has just sort of passed us not too long ago. I think what we are definitely seeing in the most current environment is we are definitely in a world of greater growth volatility. It is also an environment that we witness higher capital costs, as well as geopolitical instability. So I think this, I would say the climate that we have all been navigating through over the last couple of years, particularly so in 2023. So now, going into 2024, I think we are definitely looking at elevated inflation, muted growth, and also trying to really come out from a banking crisis that we have witnessed. And I think the continuation of the tightening of monetary policy across the global markets that we have witnessed in decades will likely to continue to evolve in 2024. I think as most had shared across various sort of economical forecasts, the higher for longer climate is likely to stay at least for a little bit longer. Uncertainty is likely going to persist as we witness the subtrend growth that's going to be projected across the global economies. The path to a soft landing appears to be visible, viable, with the growth decelerating, although we are not expecting global economics to collapse. But nonetheless, we are definitely witnessing that the effects of the monetary policy tightening working through their way in the, you know, through the financial system. And I think, you know, in 2023, we definitely see geopolitical tension. I think this escalating of geopolitical tension, as well as the ongoing macroeconomic headwinds, will definitely going to continue to test the global economies. So I would say, if in one word, I would probably put it that 2024 will likely to be a year of flux, which we are going to see many factors pressuring the global economy's path to a recovery. So I think with that, I'll probably share a little bit more in terms of how I see the overall asset classes in terms of the performance. I think when you look at 2023, we have definitely witnessed that, be it global equities, global fixed income, they are seeing, or they have witnessed, or they have seen a higher correlation, i.e. the traditional asset classes form of diversification seems to be less rewarding compared to prior years. And I would believe that 2024 will be a time of putting the pieces together. As we witness, as I shared earlier, there are many factors within the macroeconomic environment to assess, and how they sort of converge together in order for us to sort of define our outlook as well as portfolio allocation views. Given the sort of climate that I've shared earlier, you know, in terms of that, you know, 2024 is likely to be a year of looking at soft landing. There's going to be flux with many factors, you know, pressuring the recovery growth. I think equities will likely continue to see some challenges. Again, I'm referring to a global equity space will likely to see some challenges. While rates has continued to remain high at this current juncture, we have witnessed that the Fed rate is hovering at about 5.25% to 5.5%. And in fact, if you look at the Federal Reserve, they have kept this benchmark overnight interest rate unchanged in these last two FOMC policy meetings. Particularly at the very recent FOMC policy meeting that took place on October 31st to November 1st this year. This is the second meeting in a row where rates have remained unchanged. So while we see the higher for longer sort of climate in terms of yield will likely to persist a little bit longer, but I do see that fixed income is likely to be in a brighter spot for investors in 2024, given that at these current yield levels, we are seeing slowing growth as well as continued disinflation. So there could be some light towards the end of the tunnel in terms of the fixed income space. So I think the broader sense-wise, amid this heightened volatility as well as the global fragility, I'm definitely cautious on risky assets. In terms of equity, we should favor quality stocks as what we should be, you know, in the climate of navigating through the volatility. The emerging market will remain vulnerable, you know, given the current landscape, particularly the geopolitical situation that we are still seeing. And we should definitely capitalize on any opportunities within the emerging space. But it will likely to remain relatively challenging, you know, in this climate when we look at global equities. So within the fixed income space, I would probably put forth the word of caution whereby, as we witness the slowing growth, the rates are likely going to plateau in the coming quarters. I think there's been several opinions, whether is it going to be in the early part of 2024 or it's going to be a later part of 2024. But I do believe that we should see at the current environment, rates should look into plateau. And what does that mean is that there would likely to see opportunities in the fixed income market once the rate sort of plateau and start to come down. But however, having said that, you know, I think you know, none of us has crystal ball in front of them and is unlikely to be able to do a perfect market timing in regards to recognizing when the rate is going to reach its peak and started to come down. Henceforth, putting ourselves in position to capitalize on any peak of the rate hike and for the rates to sort of start to ease off would likely to be a very good opportunity for investors to move into the fixed income space. However, within a fixed income environment, I would strongly suggest that participating in the investment grade areas will likely to be beneficial. And in my view, Asian corporate investment grade bonds will likely to be a good space to look into, particularly on two areas. Number one, I think Asian corporates will continue to see growth coming off, you know, from the pandemic. And it's likely to be the region that will see the strongest growth as trade flows start to take place in a more robust way after the pandemic. Second, I think within the investment grade segment, I think it will definitely exhibit some form of risk averseness in terms of participating in companies that have good credits. And henceforth, you know, investment grade segment will likely to be less risky and more rewarding to investors from a risk-reward trade-off dimension. So I think so far, Stella, I've sort of touched on, you know, in terms of the traditional asset classes. I would probably like to expand that a little bit more into the private asset. I think as we witness the challenges through the last 2 to 3 years in the public markets, I think it is inevitable for investors to look into the alternative investment assets very, very seriously. I think in terms of, you know, alternative investment assets, I'll probably refer to the private markets. It could be real estate, private equity, private debt. I think these are the areas that will give investors an element of diversification away from the traditional asset classes. I think 2023 was a very good example where we witnessed the high correlation between public equities as well as fixed income, which is the bonds market. Henceforth, going into the alternative space, particularly the private assets, the private markets, will give investors some element of diversification as well as the opportunities to capitalize on some element of yield, but coming from the private credit areas. So I would also like to extend that discussion a little bit further, looking into the private market space. Let me sort of share a little bit in these areas. As we witness the private markets are entering a new era as well. I think the geopolitical and economic turmoil that has ended a long phase in which investors have not needed to make any strategic adjustment. But I think right now, it is really a phase where we witness that there is a lot of element of scrutinization, you know, that's required. I think in the past where we witnessed, you know, where rates, inflations were low, liquidity was abundant, value chains were growing, as a result of globalization. But the thing is, this has no longer been true, you know, evolving from pandemic. I think the investment strategies that have been successful for a long time, a decade ago, will be facing a lot of headwinds moving forward. I think there is a new phase of this investment that we are looking into, particularly as we witness there's a lot of changes in terms of technological advancement. particularly in terms of AI revolution and so on and so forth. So I think there are a few themes here we need to really consider and really be very mindful of, three of which I would say would surround decarbonization, the deglobalization, as well as the change in terms of the demographics. I think when we talk about decarbonization, this is definitely not a new word that has involved in the global markets. I think the entire aspect of decarbonization will strive further in the coming years, as we definitely could expect the entire notion of this decarbonization is going to create new opportunities in the various aspects of the sustainability investment. For example, renewable energy, infrastructure, and you know, and sort of various form of ESG investment. I think this encapsulates the expected shift towards a circular economic model, whereby, you know, where waste is designed out of the products we use and how we're going to reuse sort of the materials that's coming out from this over the sort of the recycling. I think the overall aspect of the globalization is also taking place. I think this is definitely witnessing the growing trend of the nearshoring initiatives, as we as the geopolitical tensions that we witness in terms of Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas, the shifting of power, global dynamics have definitely reshaped the entire supply chains around the world. And more so, you know, during the pandemic, this was really an area where countries around the world are recognizing the challenges in terms of the supply chains ecosystem. So while the US has been sort of a very dominant economy and political power, you know, for over half a century, but definitely is going to see a lot of competition coming through, be it from China, and more so recently, we are also seeing competition coming from India, as we also recently witnessed, you know, the India's population has crossed a significant milestone. So lastly, I think in terms of demographics-wise, it has definitely created a lot of investment opportunities, be it location. I think aging population in the developed market is bound to expect to drive sustained demand for age-restricted housing, healthcare, medical sort of, you know, advancement technology. And we're definitely seeing, you know, emerging economies like India, which I have mentioned earlier, which has a much younger population that demonstrate a lot of potential to create a huge element of growth coming from, you know, from this market. So I think with that, you know, looking forward, I would conclude by saying that investors should evaluate, you know, if the strategies of the past, will they continue to be suited in the new world that we are entering into, you know, as this is really a new era, sort of a new world they're facing. I think we are definitely in a time that we need to be forward-looking, be thoughtful, and it's going to be a new era for private assets investment. We need to focus on long-term trends, diversifying portfolios, and again, rethink the feasibility of the past strategies. So I think this will definitely help investors to navigate more successfully, you know, in this new era. So yeah, with that, I think I hope sort of shed a little bit on this sort of economics perspective with all of you. Hi, Stella.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon. I've listened to a great speech, I think. Let me try to conclude some points. Is that for fixed income, because you think that this whole environment is have to live with higher for longer. So I want to ask that, do you think it's already over the hill that the rates, the Fed rate is going to go down for the coming year? It has experienced the highest points and then will go down the next year, right?
Well, yeah, I think, Stella, thanks for the question. So I shared in the sort of earlier conversation, I think we might be seeing, you know, the higher for longer environment to likely perceive for a little longer, as what I shared earlier.
let's say, the third quarter or fourth quarter in 2024 remain this high level and then go down, and then or other forecasts you have?
I would believe that it will likely to see some form of disinflation coming through towards the second half of 2024. I think we are definitely seeing the prospect of some slowdown in terms of economic activity, right? And I think over the last two FOMC meetings, it was a signal to us as well that the overall increase in terms of the interest rate environment could likely see some sort of picking off coming into next year. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, I mean, at this current juncture, obviously Federal Reserve is not closing its doors. There wouldn't be any further rate hike in the coming quarters. But I would say that it's likely to see, well, the market consensus has it that, you know, it's unlikely to see more than two rate hikes, you know, coming through over the next two quarters. So with that in mind, I would believe that this inflationary dynamic will still has a little bit further to run, but nonetheless, we might definitely see it sort of coming through the peak in the second half of next year. And it might not be in a very swift manner, but I think we probably could see it cooling off in the second half of 2024.
So for fixed income investment, you think you can have fairly high level of rates, the return you get first, and then you can share the benefits when the rates goes down, that the price of the bonds will goes up. So is that one of the reasons you chose to invest or overweight in the fixed income markets?
Yes, I think at this current juncture, again, you know, like I shared earlier, none of us have a crystal ball. And I think it's difficult to have a perfect market timing in terms of when rates is going to peak and start to decline, and bonds market is going to start to alleviate. So this might be a good time to capitalize by, you know, channeling some of the investment into the fixed income market. But having said that, as I shared earlier, we need to be selective on it. I think at this current juncture, participating in terms of the Asian US dollar investment grade corporate bond segment were likely to be sort of giving investors a better risk-reward trade-off, as we are likely to witness better growth coming from the Asian corporates coming through, particularly coming through from the pandemic, as we are seeing more activities are coming through, and a lot of these corporates are really driving up the business activities. And second, I think participating in the investment grade will definitely give investors a little bit sort of more risk protection, if I may put it that way, versus the high yield space. As also, I think at the current juncture, the high yield continue to witness a lot of challenges. As we have witnessed, you know, sort of several defaults that have happened over the last 12 to 18 months. So henceforth, my recommendation is to look into the Asian US dollar corporate investment grade credits. I think this will likely to be a space that could be achieving a better risk reward and more rewarding for investors in the coming 12 to 24 months.
So when you mentioned the Asian US dollar investment grade corporates, you include the Chinese bonds inside or not? Because, you know...
Yes, yeah, definitely. Well, if you look at the benchmark, right, just using a reference benchmark, whether it's JECI or even the Barclays Asian US dollar corporate bonds, quite a sizable exposure actually in the Chinese corporate. We are looking at about 30 to 40% of the exposure in the Chinese corporate. So absolutely, when I mentioned the Asian US dollar corporate investment grade bonds, they definitely include Chinese companies that issues US dollar corporate credits, corporate bonds.
But are those usually the property or real estate companies. And have you ever considered the credit risk? Because we talk a lot about the downturn of the property markets in China. So when you invest in these Chinese corporate bonds, are they usually the property companies or others?
Yeah, this is a good question. In fact, the exposure to the Chinese real estate is pretty low. I think most of the Chinese real estate companies, they are probably mainly in the high yield space. So although while there's quite a large exposure to the Chinese market, but they tend to be sort of the non-real estate segments. I think if I'm going to sort of give a few names, or we look at the Chinese name, I think they are mainly sort of in the banks, in the tech sector, for example, Bank of China, Tencent, Baba, sort of, CNOOC. So these are the names that are in the sort of the Chinese US dollar corporate investment grade nature. No, we are not referring to the real estate segment.
Okay, quite similar with what we have done. And we usually avoid those property companies and investments, some banks, some, yeah.
That's right. So they are mainly the banks, the technology companies, sort of telecommunication. I think these are probably the common names that we see in terms of this US dollar investment grade corporate bonds that has exposure to the China side.
Okay, so as we talked about the corporate bonds from Baba, and we see the stocks of Baba has declined a lot. So I want to ask, is China A or Hang Seng Index, the equities, a part of your investment portfolio? And I want to ask your opinion about the equity market in China and Hong Kong.
Okay, all right. So I would probably categorize it that the Chinese market continue to be a very sizable exposure, you know, whether is it in terms of the benchmark and in terms of the sort of the global exposure that investment manager would be participating in. So I think I would probably categorize that. I would say it is essential for investors, Asian investors or global investors, to continue to have the exposure to China for the reason that, well, we have witnessed challenges, you know, over time, but I think it is a large exposure within the benchmark space, so it is very difficult for investors to sort of take a very substantial underweight in terms of the market. And secondly, I think generally speaking, we should continue to see the Chinese economy will continue to grow a bit, that probably at a slower growth rate. So now, coming into sort of Chinese market, I would probably also like to share a little bit more in terms of what we are seeing or what foreign investors are really seeing. I think we can recognize and as well as appreciate that the China's debt problems could likely take some time to resolve. You know, it's not something that is going to be happening overnight. But I think foreign investors believe that the China's economy will not crash, and that although we witness that property and the local government debt challenges are definitely undermining this country growth. But having said that, we are still seeing the GDP of China is still growing at around 5% a year, you know, looking at the recent statistic. Now, when you look at the overall debt challenges in China, the debt challenges at the central government may not be a big problem. You know, in fact, it is a relatively small issue. I would say that the main challenges we are seeing are really at the local government level, which I mentioned earlier, it might take some time for it, you know, to be resolved. But the problem at the central government is not just, I would say that it's a relatively manageable issue. Now, the problems at the China property market has not spread sort of too widely. I would say that, you know, it's affecting the banking sector, you know, I think to some extent the financial industry, construction industry, materials suppliers. But I think these are the good reasons for business and consumer sentiments, you know, at this current juncture to sort of stay relatively weak, and then confidence could be relatively low at this current juncture. But the thing is, this is not going to, I would say, you know, derail the entire sort of growth. Now, I think what we have also witnessed is that the overall positive note that could be coming through on it. If you look at just in the very recent month in November, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, they have updated China's growth forecast for 2023 to about 5.4% from 5%, right? Although, you know, growth could likely slow to about 4.6% in 2024, but this is an upgrade from the 4.2% expectation earlier. So I think the overall optimism is still relatively, I would say, reasonable. And China's balance sheet is still showing some positive financial net worth. Whereas if you look at other countries like US, Japan, Germany, they are in actually negative territory. So, you know, with that, I would say it's not a grayish picture that we are seeing. I think China's economic fundamentals are sound. The government has ample policy space to navigate and tackle its current economic slowdown. Its industrial development has positioned it well, relatively well for the future. And I think it goes to say that the China's growth, you know, will likely to continue foreseeable future. For my view, and I think this sort of extend to some of the, you know, foreign investors' view as well. So I think this is probably how I see the sort of the Chinese market sort of navigating through.
Okay, thank you. As the global investors live with the higher for longer, as we Chinese investors will have to live with a slower growth, maybe. And then as the time limits, we have to go to the next session of our discussion. It's about the operation of the Singapore Society. So can you introduce the Singapore Society to us? Like how many charter holders and the backgrounds of your board members, the activities you usually have, etc.?
Yes, sure. Happy to share that. Now, thanks, Stella. So let me share a little bit on the CFA Society Singapore. The society in Singapore started in the year 1987. So it has been about 36 years of operations that we have been through. Currently, right now, we are sitting at about 4,200 members in the society, comprising of regular members, associate members and affiliates. The regular members represent the lion's share of our membership intake, which is about close to 3,800. We are the first society that was established back then in 1987 that's outside of US. So it's the very first societies outside of US that was established. Currently, right now, the Singapore Society is ranked number 7 globally. And we are definitely thrilled that we maintain this positioning for quite a long period of time. And we continue to see some relatively healthy growth in terms of our members as well as candidates to the CFA exams. The board, so how the Singapore Society operates, we have a board that comprises of 12 members. So there are 12 board members. Out of the 12, we have 4 executive committee members who holds the position of president, deputy president, secretary, and treasurer. And each of the board members, they are also holding various portfolios in terms of chairperson or co-chairperson of various committees, which I will share a little bit later. The Singapore Society has also a secretariat office that comprises currently 8 permanent staff, which is headed by the CEO, who is definitely the sort of full-time staff. And together with him, there are 7 other members, which includes staff that looks after advocacy, events, membership, as well as the various aspects of the organizational part of the activities that society has. So the full-time secretariat office has grown over the years, and it was in 2020 that we started to professionalize the society, or rather the full-time secretariat office, when our very first CEO was hired back in 2020. So we are currently running a professional office so that they would be able to look after the various activities for our members, as well as across a very broad spectrum of activities that we do. On the average, you know, a typical year, the Singapore Society runs more than 100 events, even during pandemic in 2021 and 2022, the Society was running about 80 to 90 events in each year. So that really speaks about the volume of, in terms of activities that the Society is doing. Henceforth, a full-time secretary office was definitely necessary. So allow me to share a little bit, as what Stella has also asked, some of the activities that we do in the Singapore Society. So let me share a little bit of sort of the brick and mortar of the activities. I think similarly to many societies globally, for example, you know, such as Beijing Society as well, a lot of our activities are really centralized, targeted our members. And I think this is important because this is really for the benefit to create values for members. Some of the key highlights of activities that we do for members include professional development. This is actually talking about professional talks, seminars that we organize for our members. And typically such activities happens at least once a week, every week. So we will bring in renowned speakers from around the region. And if there are any prominent speakers that's coming through to Singapore from other parts of the world, we'll be delighted to host them and to bring keynote presentation in terms of hard skills, soft skills, geopolitical situation, macroeconomy, or even any forms of topics of interest to our members during their lunchtime as well as evening. And these are events that could potentially be a 2 hours event. It can be potentially sort of a weekend events as well. And the professional development committee will also be running investment conferences for the society, relatively similar to Beijing Society did. And I just gathered that yesterday Beijing Society had a very successful nianhui. That took place in Beijing, which brought in more than 300 participants. So congratulations to Beijing for the very successful nianhui that they have taken place. So likewise in Singapore, the Professional Development Committee will be looking into organizing various investment conference for the members as well as the investment community. Let me share a little bit on other areas, for example, the careers development. One of the very marquee events of the careers committee is what we call the mentoring program. This is a program that has been running for over the last 7 to 8 years. In fact, this year is our 8th season of this mentoring program. The mentoring program runs across a 6 months period that starts off with pairing of a mentor and a mentee. Typically, the mentors will be members who will bring with them more than 10, 15 years of experience in the industry. These are senior members of the society, whereby they will register themselves as mentor, and the society will then pair a relatively matching mentees to the mentor. These are in light of what the mentees is looking for, maybe careers, advisors, personal development, and so on and so forth. So for each run over the 6 months, we will pair at least 50 to 60 pairs of mentor and mentees using some form of algorithm to match make them in terms of their profile, their industry background, their experience, and so on and so forth. So I think this is a very meaningful activities that we're doing for our members, whereby we involve both senior and junior members, because very often we felt that, hey, we might be neglecting our senior members, as in there isn't really many activities that the senior members would be interested in, right? So henceforth, this is really a very good activity whereby both senior and junior members will come together as they will learn from each other, be it at which level of competency they are in. So these, I would say these are sort of very interesting activities that we put together. Of course, beyond that, we have networking activities which will bring members across a various spectrum, you know, to come together, network, exchange their advisors, tips, and to have some form of, you know, a fun evening with, you know, with some drinks. Beyond that, we engage a lot with university students as well through our university outreach. I think this is the element whereby it is essential for us to reach out to the younger generation, because they are the new era. They are going to be the sort of the new members of the CFA's Society Singapore in times to come, as we continue to advocate and educate to this younger generation what is the value of the CFA program and what's the value of CFA chartered designation. Beyond that, in terms of advocacy, we work a lot with the regulators, with Monetary Authority of Singapore, as well as the Institute of Banking and Finance, in terms of providing the advocacy works, such as ethics, such as ESG, sustainability, as we curate various forms of thought leadership, curriculum, professional learning materials, contents that we can deliver to our members, as well as to the broader investment industry and community. So I would say these are sort of the really the broader overarching activities that we do. And, you know, Stella, if I may, I would also like to add a little bit more flavor to that. You know, in terms of all these activities that we are doing, I think one of the key element which I believe is very important in terms of the society works is how each societies from the different countries can collaborate as well as work together with the other societies regionally and globally. And I think I would like to share a few examples over here, such as I mentioned a little bit about the Maki program, the Maki activities in terms of our mentoring program. When we first started a mentoring program 8 years ago, it is actually a very fresh program that we witness in Asia, as particularly in the Southeast Asia. I think as we sort of evolve, as we expand this mentoring program, we learn from it, and over time, we put together some handbook in terms of guidelines on how should we be conducting this mentoring program more successfully. So with this learning, as we progress, you know, in this mentoring program, we share this program with other societies that has approached us in terms of the bolts and nuts of how this mentoring program can be conducted. So I think this is an area that we share our handbook in terms of how should we be conducting this, you know, what is the step one to step 10, how shall we be putting an algorithm together to match make mentors and mentees so that they will have a more meaningful engagement. So these are the areas that we share very actively with the other societies. Now, I would also like to share another examples, which I would say this was done many years ago, although currently right now, we sort of took a little bit of break from it. It was really the ethics challenge. I think everybody has heard about University Investment Research Challenge. I think this is really a global challenge that every society will also conduct their local challenge within their country, within their city. We started the ethics challenge more than 8 years ago, and we had a couple of runs that started off first in domestic in Singapore. And as we sort of progress, we involve societies from other countries and invited teams from other countries into Singapore to participate in this competition, whereby we will have an ethics case study and what the teams would do. And again, these are students' team, because these are really targeted at the universities. The team will study the ethics case and identify the ethics dilemma and offer solutions to this ethics dilemma. So this is one of those competitions that we put together and involve societies across Southeast Asia, such as Malaysia and Thailand. Now, moving forward, I think moving forward is definitely essential as well as critical for us to work together in a more collaborative manner across the societies, across Asia Pacific, not just only in Southeast Asia. For example, how we can sort of involve and collaborate together with societies such as Beijing societies, or even, you know, Shanghai, Shenzhen, you know, coming together to share our thought leadership. And I think one of the areas that I have in mind, and in fact, this is something that we're going to put together in times to come, is how we can push forward professional learning, particularly how we can take professional learning and elevate it to the next higher sort of level, whereby we could come together, curate the content, put the thought leadership together, and we can then bring it to the various areas, to the various cities, to share these teachings. You know, be it in a very specific topic such as ESG, such as climate investing, such as data science, and beyond. And in fact, as we speak, the Singapore societies has already curated several curriculum contents in-house, whereby we are happy to, you know, bring it beyond Singapore and to see how some of the regional societies would like to tap into these resources, as, you know, it's definitely a more meaningful use of these resources if we can sort of leverage on each other's capabilities, talents, to take these contents and thought leadership to the various segments of the industry. So I think this is definitely going to be a very meaningful proposition for all the societies to be able to come together and share this.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. I think our mission is quite similar, to create value for our members. And you have mentioned you have a professional development committee, which is very impressive that you hold seminars once a week. And you have the career development committee, which has mentoring programs, is also very impressive. So are these different development committees running by the full-time staff or is by your volunteers?
Yes, so very good point here. By and large, as the board will lay out strategic directions in terms of what are the areas that the society should be more involved in and should be engaging into, so as to further develop members' values as well as to upgrade the entire professionalism within the industry. So within the board, we have chair and co-chairs, and they will look after the various committees such as professional developments, careers developments, mentoring program, university outreach, advocacy, professional learning, so on and so forth. At the board level, we will also engage, or rather the chairperson will engage volunteers within the committee. The volunteers will come together, put their brains together to identify some of the key areas of a segment of development that we can do. For example, initiatives. Which are the areas of initiatives that we should participate in, that we should put together, that we should commence. Through these ideas, the initial aspect in terms of the entire initialization will come from volunteer. Then the board and the volunteers will then involve the full-time staff. Because at the end of the day, these full-time secretariat members, the staff, the full-time secretariat members of the society will then need to reach out to address the logistics and administrative aspect of putting these activities together. So it is a very collaborative effort between the volunteers, okay, the board, the volunteers, and the full-time secretary. At the end of the day, we definitely count on the full-time secretary team to be able to iron out the logistics, the on-the-ground works, the administrative aspect, for example, how they're going to register the members, how they're going to make sure the venues are in place, the registration, and so on and so forth. So definitely the full-time secretary team is very critical for us to be able to make these events happen as well as for these events to take place.
And for the mentoring program, I'm quite interested in that. How can you evaluate the effect or say the change after the mentoring program for the junior members? And how can the senior members keep doing this mentoring work? What can they get or how can they benefit from this mentoring program, both for the junior and senior?
Okay. All right. Thanks, Stella.
Because it may take a lot of time, you know, for, as you said, a 6 months mentoring, it takes a lot of their personal time, their working time. So I'm just curious about it.
Indeed. Okay. Yes, very good point that you brought up. Let me start off by addressing the mentee side. Okay, I think this is probably the easier aspect. In the sense that for mentees, I think any form of interaction with senior mentors will benefit, whether is it in terms of professional development aspect or even personal development aspect. I think very often, of course, when we start off this mentoring program, one of the areas that we emphasize a lot is the mentoring program is not a career-seeking event. It is not an event whereby the mentees goes in and hope that they will get a new job out of it. I think that is not the motivation of the mentoring. While it is true that mentees, they do go into this program hoping to seek professional advisors, professional development advisors from the mentors. But I think there's also quite an element of personal development. Because through the interaction, to hearing the mentors, how they have evolved, how they have elevated themselves in the industry, I think there's a lot that these mentees can learn, appreciate in terms of, you know, how the mentors have navigated through this industry over the last decade or more than a decade. So I think this itself, it is a soft element. You know, it is not something that you go in, you try to learn a hard skill. I think it's something that you go in, you try to appreciate the sort of the soft aspect of the personal development growth, potentials, personal development growth that you can gain from the mentors. So by and large, by the end of the entire 6 months, we carry out a halfway evaluation. At the end of the 3 months, we carry out a full evaluation after the 6 months program, and we have received very good feedback from the various mentees who have been involved in this program. Now, coming back to the mentors, I think indeed it is a commitment by the mentors. 6 months through, although over the 6 months, I think by and large, most of the pairings, they will probably meet maybe about 12 times, 10 to 12 times over 6 months. Maybe every 2 to 3 weeks, they'll meet once. Some could probably meet less if, you know, time doesn't permit. But I would say at a very minimum, they will meet at least once a month. That will give them about 6 meetings over the 6 months. So in terms of time commitments, I would say it's relatively reasonable. I think when the mentors sign up for it, they know what they're in for. They know the kind of time commitment that's required. So what is really in it for the mentors? I think I will probably look at it from two folds. Number one is that it's a little bit of returning back to the society. I think when any senior members of the society who sign up as volunteers, I think in Beijing society, you will also have witnessed senior members coming together, spending time with the societies. I think this is really a part of them, you know, returning back to the society, you know, recognizing that, you know, they have received a lot from the society in the past. It's time for them to see how they can contribute. So I think this definitely represents a big part of them wanting to contribute to the society. Now, what about the second part? I believe the second part is also that as mentors, they also appreciate that they can learn from the younger generation. They can learn something from someone of a different generation. Why do I say that? As we have witnessed, the economy has evolved, whereby I talked a little bit about just now, you know, in terms of the deglobalization, the demographics, the decarbonization, the new era of AI, you know, the new era of this entire aspect of the technological advancement breakthrough. Senior members recognize there is something among the younger generation that they were not exposed to, and they can also learn a lot by interacting through the interaction with this younger generation. Similarly for myself, I always appreciate time that I can spend talking to the next generation, because we know there are certain things that they have seen in the market which we are blinded by it, because day in, day out, we have been so occupied by the things that we always do every day, you know, over the last decade, over, you know, and the thing is, we could be in a box ourselves whereby we need to interact with people, with the next generation, with people outside our generation, in order to appreciate what is really new in this, in the industry, whether is it in the industry or outside industry. So I think as senior members, they appreciate this is valuable. Henceforth, they are willing to step forward, whether be it as part of contribution to the society, returning back to the society, or even learning from the next generation. I think these are all values for both mentees and mentors as well.
Right. Actually, they learn from each other. It's not one side, it's a by side, right?
Exactly.
Right. And a mentor and the volunteers are really caring about the development of new members, and they are devoting themselves to the society. And I want to know something about your... is there any activities that you shared with the CFA institution? Because, you know, in Beijing society, we have a... like CFA Research Journal that's already collaborated with a CFA institution. So I want to know, is there any activities in Singapore society that you collaborate with CFA institution?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think in Singapore, we work very closely, or rather the Singapore society works very closely with Institute of Banking and Finance, which is accreditation body. You know, a professional accreditation body that is part of the Monetary Authority of Singapore. So the Singapore societies, while we curate the various form of professional learning contents and curriculum, we do get all these professional learning contents and curriculum to get it accredited with the IBF. And likewise, you know, we offer CFA examination, preparatory program. And these programs have also received the accreditation with IBF. And as part of this accreditation, we will receive funding for any students who would like to take up all these courses. So as we speak, we are also working with CFA Institute in terms of getting the various form of certification, the various form of the programs that the CFA Institute has curated to bring it into Singapore here and to have it accredited with IBF, so that we are able to offer it here in Singapore, and students, candidates will be able to receive some form of funding from the government by taking up all these professional learning courses. So I think this is definitely something that we've been doing, and we definitely look forward to doing more with CFA Institute in terms of bringing in the various form of CFA level 1, 2, 3, the various form of certification in here to get it accredited with IBF so as to be able to offer it here in Singapore, and perhaps, you know, even how we can see to sort of leverage on it to expand it out within the industry.
Okay, thank you, Simon. And it just comes to me that for the mentoring program, actually, I think we can collaborate. Because, you know, nowadays, more and more Chinese students go to Singapore and some immigration to Singapore. So I think the mentor program, we can collaborate. That's maybe it is one idea, yeah.
Indeed. I think absolutely. I think this is something that we probably can find ways on how we can, you know, bring the program to Beijing, or even to see how we can work with, you know, having a match made, you know, it could be a virtual match made between the sort of mentors and mentees from two different societies, as this is a very good cultural exchange, or even, you know, sort of a cross-cultural exchange between the two countries and two cities.
Right. So as we talked here, I want to know, do you know any current immigration policies or your experience to help your employees when they apply for the visa, this kind of experience?
Right. Well, I probably not in a sort of best position to talk about the sort of policy, because this is sort of really at a governmental level. But having said that, I would like to share that I think Singapore continue to remain very open to foreign talent. And I think this is something that we are conscious of. And I think this continues to be a message that Singapore would like to bring to the foreign markets, to the foreign countries, because I think it's important to recognize that to ensure the Singapore economy to grow over the longer term, I think Singapore needs to remain open to foreign talent, because there is more for everyone to share. I think this is essential. So let me give a little bit of statistics over here. Singapore right now has a total population of about 5.9 million. Now, it's a small island. It's sort of getting a little bit crowded. Maybe, you know, that maybe there's some of the comments that we receive. So out of 5.9 million population, Singapore citizens represent about 3.6 million. We probably have about 0.5 million of permanent residents, right? So that makes up our residents population to be about 4.1, 4.2 million. Now, if you take 5.9 million, taking away 4.1, 4.2 million, we are talking about a good close to 1.7 to 1.8 million of foreign workers who are here on the various form of work visa. While Singapore, there are a few different categorization of work visa. I probably will not expand it over here, because you know, I'm probably not the best person to talk about the differences. But we do have a few different kind of sort of work visa, such as employment pass, S pass, and so on and so forth. But I just would like to, you know, share that I think we will have to remain open, because if we close our doors to the world, we will be shooting ourselves in the foot. Because the world is just going to move on. They're just going to bypass us. They're going to be more competitive, and we will lose our competitiveness, you know, as a financial hub, as a fintech hub, or logistic hub, and so on and so forth. So over here, I'm not just purely talking about finance. I'm talking about even beyond finance industry. Now, of course, Singapore's citizen is going to be conscious, is going to be worried about, you know, jobs. But I think the Singapore government has come up very well. They have spoken up, they have advocate and educate, you know, Singaporeans that the government will always ensure that local workers will be treated fairly in the workplace. They will invest into the workers. As you probably have heard a lot over the last couple of years, we are talking about upskilling, lifelong learning, upgrading of skill set, so that they will remain relevant as well as continue to be employable, you know, in their various careers. But having said that, I think Singapore has recognized, we have to recognize that we are definitely lacking in areas of specific skill set. So we definitely need these foreign workforce to come in to complement what is missing and what is lacking in Singapore. I mean, I think these are definitely very important. I'll just probably share a few other examples as well. There's going into financial services. I think if we go into financial services, we are definitely seeing, you know, areas across banking, insurance, asset management, payment services. I think these we have seen growth. I mean, these are pretty broad-based growth. We continue to grow very stably, you know, in terms of being a leading fund management hub here. I think, you know, this, we hope that this will continue to evolve as well. But we are also seeing that there are areas where lacking in terms of talents, in terms of very specific skill set. For example, if you just look at technology, there's been an increasing pervasive use of technology in our financial sector. I think this is a key driver of our growth. Financial institutions in Singapore are making significant investment in technology, you know, major banks, asset management, insurance. We are all accelerating our digital transformation and ramping up higher in terms of application development, data science, AI, data management, machine learning, and so on and so forth. So all these requires skill set that are very specific in terms of technology aspect. And even more so, over the last 2-3 years, we are also seeing the heightened needs as well as requirements in terms of cybersecurity, right? So we are also recognizing that the involvement of cybersecurity centers in Singapore, we are seeing a lot more headcounts as being required who can focus on technology with regards to this form of sort of cybersecurity skill set. So these are areas where we need very specific element of talents that are very proficient in these areas of skill set. So henceforth, I think with this, we definitely will continue to see an involvement of a requirement of foreign talents who have this niche area of skill set that can come in to support and to complement what is really the shortfall over here in Singapore. So henceforth, I think I just would like to also mention that. Well, again, I don't know what is the numbers we are looking at. I don't know, you know, how much are we bringing in, how much visa we are giving a year. But I would say that the Singapore economy, the Singapore workforce will have to remain open to foreign talents. And I think we are definitely seeing a lot of Chinese foreign talents coming here into Singapore over the last several years. Although, yes, indeed, during the pandemic time, during the 2 years of pandemic, we definitely witnessed challenges with our foreign talents, foreign workers here in Singapore. But I think as we continue to witness the opening up of the borders, which we can appreciate, we will be seeing more of our foreign talents coming here to fill the gaps as well as to continue to help Singapore to grow into a more renowned hub, be it, you know, in the financial aspect or even beyond the financial sector.
And is the CFA charter holder preferable by the corporates?
Well, I think, you know, Stella, I would say that this would likely to be a similar kind of response across the various global markets. I think CFA charter designation continue to remain what we call the gold standards in the financial sector. I think, you know, we can continue to recognize that the charter is a highly sought after credential. If anyone would like to remain competitive in this industry and to remain relevant in this industry. So I will say it is, you know, it's continued to be highly valued and highly treasured by the financial institution in Singapore.
Yeah, and your soft skill is also very important. And my last question will be, is there any new trend that you have observed in recent years in Singapore for financial professionals? Like the family office, or because I noticed a lot of family office established in Singapore these days.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I was about to sort of touch on that. I think probably two areas of it. Yes, indeed. I think the growth of the family offices in Singapore has really witnessed an exponential growth over the last 1-2 years. I think as we speak right now, we are easily seeing more than 1,100 family offices that is established. Some are probably in the process of getting their relevant licenses, but it has definitely witnessed a huge growth as Singapore continue or sort of continue to pursue to be the hub. And more so, I think, with the stability in the financial system over here, as well as these high scrutinization in terms of our anti-money laundering policies, our cybersecurity proficiency, I think we will continue to be the central hub for family offices around the world that would like to pursue to set up their offices over here and to have a footprint over here. I would say the next element of it would likely to be on the sustainability space. I think you have also heard from the COP28, you know, we are definitely stepping up a lot of efforts in terms of the building up, developing strategies to build up a comprehensive ecosystem for sustainability, for green transition financing. And we are definitely aligning a lot of financing efforts with credible sectorial transition plans, you know, provide clarity about transition pathway, carbon emission targets, so that this will in turn generate investor confidence and help to catalyze greater sustainable finance flow. And we are also I think as a country, as industry here, the country is stepping up efforts to enhance collection of emission data, develop credible transition taxonomies, implement consistent climate-related reporting and disclosure. I think consistent here is very critical as we witness there's a lot of reporting disclosure standards that is really quite vast around the world. So having a consistent implementation is definitely very critical. So I think we are definitely seeing the harnessness of this element to address the financial sector's sustainability data needs so that it can be a more transparent, trusted, efficient ESG ecosystem here that we hope to see in Singapore. So yes, I think these are probably the two areas that we have witnessed strong development, and we will continue to see development in this space.
Okay, thank you. That's all my questions for today's interview. And thank you, Simon.
Thank you very much, Stella. And thank you very much to Beijing Society interview and to host this chat session. Definitely very honored and privileged to be invited to this. And I definitely look forward to more of such session in the future. And I definitely enjoy myself very much in this conversation. And thank you very much to Beijing Society. Thank you.
And here's a note. All information contained here in the broadcast is the personal views from the guests, not the institutional views from Safe Institution, Safe Society Beijing, Safe Society Singapore, or the organization the guests are working for. And thank you guys. Thank you for listening to China Charter Chat. I hope to see you again. Bye-bye.